You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 7th of December 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, the US President takes the rare step of addressing the American people from the Oval Office.
For 7 years, I have confronted this evolving threat each and every morning in my intelligence briefing. And since the day I took this office, I have authorized US forces to take out terrorists abroad precisely because I know how real the danger is.
Barack Obama wants people to know that his administration is ahead of the terror threat. Is he right? Meanwhile, in France, did the lingering threat of further terrorist attacks play a part in electoral victories for the country's far right at the weekend? We'll also look at a leaked document from the so-called Islamic State that apparently outlines its vision of a nation. Plus, Venezuela's government is ousted and Colombia stumbles upon the treasure of a lifetime. That's all to come in Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House, and my guests today are Mary Dzhajewski, who's the columnist for the Independent newspaper, among many other things here in London, and also the former British diplomat John Everard. Welcome both to the programme. Now, our first topic for today is in the US, because President Barack Obama took the relatively rare step of addressing the nation from the Oval Office on Sunday evening. Many had expected his speech to outline how the government would continue tackling the threat of terrorism after last week's attack in San Bernardino that killed 14 people. But Barack Obama did not allude to any new strategies. Instead, he sought to reassure the American public that his leadership is well ahead of the issue. But with many agreeing that last week's shooting spree was almost impossible to predict, are US authorities really still in the lead? Mary, it was an interesting speech because it was one of reassurance. He was attempting to say, this is something we discuss all the time, I'm up on this, don't worry about it, we kind of have it covered. But do you think that would be something that the American public would respond to and think, oh, we can calm down now? Or would they have been hoping to hear some new measures?
Well, it was interesting how you presented it, because that struck me too. And it sounded almost a European speech in its sort of tone and its approach to the subject. And judging by the response, at least from presidential contenders next time around, they were deeply unhappy. And of course, for political reasons, you know, it makes sense to score political points where you can. But I'm not sure that that approach goes down particularly well with Americans generally. I mean, it's all very well to say after attacks in London, say, or Paris, that, you know, we have a large Muslim population, that Muslims by and large are peace-loving, and we've all got to get on happily, and this is a very, very rare occurrence. But that's not necessarily an American approach.
John, also interesting, because I guess the attacks in San Bernardino were so off the radar of all of the authorities. Nobody had been tracking this couple. Everyone thought that they were happy, normal couple just living in the States. And then suddenly there was, you know, this terrible kind of killing spree. So in a way, would it have been better for him to be honest and say the reality which is being faced here in Europe, you know, that we will do our best, but actually we're at a point when there are so many potential attacks, so many potential targets, that some people will get through?
I thought that was close to what actually he did say. I mean, he didn't claim that he had a one-size-fits-all solution to San Bernardino or any copycat attacks. One thing he did say very clearly, and I think this must count as a new measure, is that he's going to tackle the gun lobby, which in America, of course, requires considerable political courage. The quite clear condemnation of the ability to go into a gun shop and to buy automatic weapons, even if, for example, you are on a no-fly list, he rightly pointed out, is an absurdity and has to be stopped. So he's going to have his horns locked with quite a powerful lobby of this for a while. The other part of the strategy is simply to keep ISIS on the back foot. You probably cannot stop San Bernardino lookalike attacks. Standard counter-terrorist operations will not pick up these people, and there are going to be more of them. What you can do is to keep ISIS so worried about whether ISIS leaders are going to wake up in the morning, that they stop planning actually ISIS-directed attacks of that kind. So you take up part of the threat, you can't cope with all of it.
Mary, John says that that discussion with the gun lobby will take some time. That will take forever, won't it? There is no movement within American politics that would be ever see you successfully tackle that gun lobby, is there?
No, I mean, I spent 5 years in Washington, and I came away with absolutely the impression that there is no shifting American guns, basically. You know, there is a small group that says gun crime is scandalous, we lose this many people every year, people go on the rampage with guns who should never have got hold of them. All that is true. But the right to carry a weapon, the right to carry a firearm, is sort of inscribed in a Bill of Rights for Americans, and they will never give it up. And I think in some ways it's almost admirable for an administration to allow the degree of carrying firearms in the US that there is. And in a way, it's maybe surprising that there aren't more crimes and more accidents than there are. But it's
there's a huge amount, isn't there?
Well, there is, but there is compared with other places. But there is it represents a degree of trust in your population that those weapons won't be turned on the administration. And I think it's a degree of trust that almost no government in the world, in any country, actually has in its citizens.
I wonder how much the debate has changed, because you say it would not be turned on the administration. You know, you see all of these kind of conspiracy theories. You see people, you know, there is a sense that actually, if they felt that American government was coming to take those guns off them, they potentially would turn them on law enforcement officers, on the army. There's something in the States which is more of a disjuncture than you see here in say Europe, where people really do feel that the state has no business really coming anywhere near them. And I don't know. I think some people would turn those guns on administrators. What do you think, John?
I think that if Obama had gone all out and tried to ban guns, yes, first you'd have civil war. But these people, as you say, might well have used the guns they already hold against law enforcement officers. I thought it was therefore very clever of him not to do that. He picked out two specific targets. One was the right to carry not just weapons, but automatic weapons. The great majority of Americans who carry guns carry single-shot handguns. And I think if you try to stop that, you'd have real trouble. A lot of those who carry single-shot handguns have little sense of common feeling with those who feel the need to carry automatic weapons. That was the first thing. And the second thing was the people who are on no-fly lists ought not to be able to carry guns. And I think he's going to get quite a lot of support for that. Let's see.
We're going to move on to France, but, you know, we're not really changing topics. In fact, this theme is going to run through the first few stories on the show today, because the first round of regional elections took place in France on Sunday. And if it's any indication of things to come, the Front National's dream of national governance couldn't be closer. After cleansing the party of its extremists and applying a fresh coat of supposedly mainstream political appeal, Marine Le Pen's bid to lure disenfranchised working class voters appears to be paying off. But could an anti-European, anti-immigration political force really make it all the way to the top of France's political pile? Mary, do you think that we've seen a real shift at the weekend? We must also point out that in many countries, you see something happening regionally when people want to make a bit of a protest, but when it actually comes to national politics and them changing their minds again. So this isn't necessarily, you know, a real clear indication of what would happen in any national election, but a real shift. And these are all these realignments we're talking about in politics, in security. And this is the French version of it, which has actually seen people want to bring in the right. Why do you think that was?
Well, I think there were lots of reasons, but I think the bombings in Paris were the immediate impetus for people voting for the National Front. And the moment those bombings happened and you realised the proximity of the regional elections, actually, I thought the result would be more, that the National Front would get a bigger majority than it actually got in the first round. The second thing to say is that the National Front has long had quite a strong representation representation in the grassroots. And the question is how far it comes to the surface, how visible it is. And at the moment, it is, as the result showed, very visible. But if you look back to 2002, which is when Marine Le Pen's father entered the runoff for the presidency, what you then saw is the response of the French majority. And what you had there was something that repeatedly you've had every time the National Front in France looks as though it's going to enter the mainstream. What you have is all the other parties link together, form an alliance which they called the Republican Front, i.e. a front in defence of the French Republic, and they make the National Front into a minority. And the question is whether that tendency can ever be overcome, whether the National Front can ever skip over that alliance of the other parties to become a majority, or if a sort of sense of democracy in France says, well, you know, give the National Front their vote, allow their vote to be translated into power, which they don't do. Hitherto, they've refused to do that.
John, interesting, after the attacks of the Bataclan Club and at the stadium and in the streets of Paris, there was a sense, you saw François Hollande really kind of try and take over this kind of this position of, you know, doing something, of being almost a man of the right. He sounded like when his speeches, this was a war against the terrorists. He was going to, you know, not stop, let anyone get in his way. But it doesn't seem to have helped his party.
No, it doesn't, does it? And I think this is the other important half of what we're watching. We're watching not just the advance of the National Front. We are watching the retreat of the Socialist Party. Certainly, I agree with Mary that what happened in Paris will have been a significant element in what happened. But it's not the only one. And this has been building over quite some time, that a lot of lower middle class, working class French people are moving in large numbers to the National Front, simply because they believe that the National Front now better represents their interest than the Socialist Party. I was rather touched to see a lot of Socialist deputies say that when the National Front actually start to exercise power, a point that Mary just touched on, they will make such a hash of it that the public will throw them out. Frankly, having watched what the Socialist Party has done over the last however many years, I mean, it's not a demanding standard to have a better administration than they have offered. It could cut the other way. We might find the National Front in office are rather good.
Yeah, well, I mean, the National Front has been in office in that they've had local mayordoms in some quite big cities, in Toulon in the south, for instance. They had the city government. Generally, each time it's been a bit like British National Party in Britain. The moment they get anywhere near power, basically the next time they get voted out. And that's happened, I think, in almost every city where the National Front has almost ever taken power. I think there's another sort of interesting angle, which is also a slight parallel with Britain, in that the lower middle class, they used to vote, their vote used to be split between the communists and the National Front. Mm-hmm. And as the communists have waned, so the National Front has grown in its appeal. And it's a little bit like Britain, where UKIP has taken votes not necessarily from the Conservatives, it's taken them from the left, and it's taken them from the working class left. And something similar has been happening in France, because they see their migration is a big issue for both these groups. And that has drawn them, along with the deliberate courting by the National Front, that's drawn them to Marine Le Pen. And she's made a very effective job of it.
But that sense of protest, because, you know, they're not directly comparable. But here in the UK, we had a by-election in Oldham East. And there was a prediction that the right would do very well. But in fact, people voted for the left, for a party being led by somebody who most people think is making a bit of a hash of it, and Jeremy Corbyn. But somehow that was the way to make a protest. So I also wonder, in this instance, you know, how much of this was real politics at play and how much was protest? Because, again, the other funny thing, John, is, you know, after Paris and after, everyone said, we don't want France to change. But if they don't want France to change, this is, you know, voting for change in a way, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely it is. And yes, I can understand that people say they don't want France to change as a result of terrorist atrocities. You don't want to hand terrorists on a plate the satisfaction of knowing that they can change your society. But the fact is, France is changing. I mean, are tectonic plates moving in French politics? And as I say, I think the regional results that we've just seen are at least part of that.
And what do you feel about the kind of the notion of, you know, keeping some kind of social cohesion going? Because the other interesting thing is, obviously, while Marine Le Pen has tried to kind of step away from the real out-and-out racist within her party, it's still a party of the right that doesn't really believe in immigration. And although it carries along some people in within the party fold who are actually migrants, who again, are nervous of a world of change and perhaps see their positions threatened by more people arriving in France. Yeah. Do you think that this is a terrible future for France and this notion of trying to, you know, integrate the people who live in the banlieue, who live in poverty?
Well, I think that's the social tensions in France because of immigration and because of the way it's been handled, because of the separation and de facto apartheid exists in so many French cities, then there's a huge amount of work for any French government to do, both at local and national level, to try and address that. But the problem is, at the moment, because France is still going through an era of austerity, the problem is that the money isn't there to do that. And one of the things that strikes me whenever I've been to cover National Front rallies, or you watch a sort of Marine Le Pen or someone going campaigning, the audience, you can identify them immediately, are the French poor. And the poor in France are, I would say, much more visible than they are in lots of other countries of Europe, because, you know, being smart and looking fashionable and looking chic in France is something that really counts. And when you see people who are on the other side of the tracks, that's all the things they're not. And it's very, very visible.
But I think as outsiders, we forget the power of the right in France, in a way that you don't see here in the UK. I was in France during a demonstration to the statue of Joan of Arc in Paris, and thousands of people marching, and they were effectively, some of them dressed as like black shirts, and there was a scary thing to watch. You know, a fight broke out in front of the statue of Joan of Arc, and we were just standing, you know, by the Louvre, wandering across the road, and just watch this scene unfold. And I thought you would not see that in the centre of London. That there is, you know, it's not the biggest constituency, but there is a noisy far right, really tough demographic at play.
Yes, I think that's right, and I think that is coming more and more to the fore. Whether it stays as tough as it is at the moment, or whether it softens the experience of power and the general knockabout of politics, we'll have to watch. But I think the National Front is here to stay. And I mean, Mary's pointed out quite rightly that where we have had any approach by the National Front to the presidency, the rest of France has rallied around and prevented that. That is true. I'm not so sure that we can count on that happening every time in the future. And I think Sarkozy's refusal, for example, to withdraw his candidates, even when they're clearly going to lose for the second round of the regional election on 13 December, may be a straw in the wind.
Well, I think also, I mean, it is a mark of democracy. I mean, I've always been slightly worried by this building of the Republican Front, because basically it is highly anti-democratic. It doesn't give, it makes it easy for the National Front to claim to be victims and to be victims of a false democratic process. And I think if that changes, then that's probably to the good.
We should just bring in the third element of this this story today, because some papers have been released to the Guardian newspaper here in the UK, which show what this so-called Islamic State would like to see is their version of a country or caliphate. A leaked blueprint of their plans, which was obtained by the newspaper, outlines a vision of functioning government departments, economic programs, propaganda machines, and how it will maintain control over its oil reserves. So with economic plans in place, will it ever be enough to rely on airstrikes alone to defeat the group? John, what did you make of these plans?
Firstly, I'm astonished that people now appear to be saying that they thought that Daesh, Islamic State, whatever we're calling it, were just a rabble who were hell-bent on terror and slaughter. I've never been in any doubt that they are trying to build a state. And if these documents help to focus our minds on that, then I'm very glad they've come out. They are not a particularly exciting set of documents. I mean, they set out what departments do what, you know, a general blueprint for government, such as you get in a lot of, for example, stabilization papers here in the West. But does that mean that strategy against the Islamic State is wrong? No, I don't think it does. I think it means that you know, there is a military campaign that has to be waged. There's no way that you are going to be able to negotiate with people like Islamic State towards any kind of sensible common position. But it does emphasize the fact that they believe that they are here to stay. And it also, I think, leads you to the conclusion that in the end, the only people who are going to be able to prevent this state taking root are Sunni Arabs themselves. That putting in foreign armies is probably not going to work.
Mary, what do you make? I thought there was one interesting thing here that, you know, that if we're saying their aim or their dream is to have, you know, effectively a state that they run and they manage, and that's, you need some modicum of peace to be able to do that. So the interesting thing is, if you're bombing out, you know, the infrastructure, you're stopping that happening, you're making sure that hospitals don't run well and schools, kids don't go to them, in a way you are disrupting their long-term ambition. You're making it impossible for them to realize what they wanted. Both of you diving in. Let Mary go first. Do you think that they really do want to have a state where they can be left alone to run the state? Or do you think that actually by bombing them, we're making sure that they never get to their kind of ambition?
Well, I'm very torn about this. I mean, I agree absolutely that all the, as it were, you could call it Western propaganda that's tried to dismiss Islamic State, including in the very words, by denying that this has anything to do with a state, these documents suggest that is actually totally, totally wrong. That their ambition, if not the fact at the moment, is to be a state. And it may be so that bombing frustrates that ambition, but I don't think it kills it, and it may even strengthen it, because if your ideal is it seems to be a very strange mixture of the medieval and the modern, the religious caliphate on the one hand and the modern methods of government, as in the methods of propaganda that we've already seen. And I don't think that it's possible to say that this can't happen. And I don't think that bombing is the way you're necessarily going to destroy it. It may destroy it as the sort of organs of state, but if you're aspiring to something else, like equivalent to nationhood, that's not going to go.
John, you wanted to dive in there.
Yes, I did. Thanks. I think I think it's a mistake to assume that because here we have clear evidence that they're trying to build a state, that they want that state to be peaceful or that they need peace. It's quite clear from these documents that a lot of the administration that they are trying to create is aimed at expanding their borders. I mean, this is a crusader state. Actually, crusader state is probably the worst possible thing to call it, but I hope you understand what I mean. These are people who believe they have a mission and they want to build a state around that mission, but the mission is eventually to take over the entire the entire Muslim world with their own brand. And you can argue about whether bombing or is the right way forward, but there is no way that we can avoid a military confrontation with these people. These people form a state, fine, but they're all about fighting.
Well, we could have gone back to the very beginning of the program, because Mr. Obama doesn't seem so keen on that. But we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, Mary Jajewski and John Everard. Coming up next, Venezuela tells its government to pack its bags, and Colombia fulfills the fantasy of anyone who's ever dreamed of stumbling upon long-lost treasure.
The Monocle Minute is our daily email bulletin covering all the topics we're passionate about, from global affairs to retail news, finance to urbanism, architecture to transport. Packed with opinions and reports from around the globe, it's a unique briefing on the day from our editors and correspondents. Go to monocle.com to sign up for free today, and we'll send you the Monocle Minute to your inbox every weekday and deliver you a special weekend edition, which brings you the best in hospitality, retail, food and drink, and culture. Monocle. keeping an eye and an ear on the world every day of the week.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are Mary Jezewski and John Everard. Now, after nearly two decades of socialist dominance in Venezuela's capital, the governing party was sent packing after the weekend's elections. About 5 hours after polls closed, the Electoral Council announced the result, forcing President Maduro to concede defeat. Among the key election issues was a fundamental shortage of food staples, such as milk, rice, coffee and sugar. But the problems facing Venezuela might run much, much deeper. With the nation struggling amid the highest inflation on the continent and a painfully low price for its main export, oil. Mary, the end of the revolution?
Well, it does look rather like that, doesn't it? And it's hard in some ways not to feel just a tinge of regret because it did seem so heroic and it was such a classic sort of revolutionary regime for the time that it lasted. So I think you bid farewell to a sort of period piece in a way. But obviously, I mean, there was no way really that any elected government could actually survive in the conditions that the voters were experiencing. I mean, you can't have shortages of basic staple foods. You can't have high unemployment to that level. And you can't have the sort of exigencies that people were experiencing. They're going to vote out the government. That's the weapon they've got.
But yeah. John Mary says, you know, you feel a tinge of regret maybe, but I'm not sure if you're one of the many political prisoners who's potentially about to be released that you'll be regretting the change.
No, I agree with you. I think there was a kind of heroic moment right at the beginning of the Chavez regime, but that wore off very quickly. I think actually that the regime was doomed the moment that Chavez died. He had the kind of personal magic to hold things together. Maduro, bless him, simply doesn't. Nice man in many ways, but he just doesn't rouse the rabble in the way that Chavez did. One important point that I think is in danger of being submerged here that comes very clearly is Venezuela, for all this, for all the dominance of the socialists all this time, remains democracy. That we've had a vote and that the Maduro has accepted the results. There's been no attempt at intimidation, no attempt at ballot box stuffing, anything like that. The voting process worked. Hallelujah. It's not a bad basis on which to build a future government.
Well, they did kind of restrict the opposition's access to the media. They kind of arrested many people. They made sure that many people weren't allowed to stand on. Yeah, they did everything in their power and capacity to nudge away democracy in the run-up to the election. It's just the actual result was such a kind of landslide. They couldn't avoid it, I guess.
Well, yes, that's right. It was... I mean, you could say much the same about many American elections, couldn't you?
I think that's a bit harsh. But
one other way of looking at this, which I think is quite important, I think it's almost the first elected government to fall as a direct result of the fall in oil prices, and it may only be the first.
And I think the fall in oil price caused a devastating effect on the Venezuelan economy. We have to remember that with oil prices as they are at the moment, a lot of the Venezuelan wells simply cannot produce economic. The cost of production are higher than the price they get for the oil.
And it comes at a very interesting moment as the Peronists are kind of pushed out of power in Argentina, as Dilma Rousseff in Brazil faces, you know, catastrophic ratings. But that's for another day, because we're going to move across the border now. Because in Colombia, well, it's not quite the border, but we're going to move to Colombia, where they've discovered the location of the galleon San Jose. It's baffled experts for many years where exactly it had sunk. But it contains treasure, which is said to be worth $3 billion. Well, it's quite interesting. It's obviously a Spanish galleon. When you have a windfall like this as a nation, I presume it kind of bucks you up a little bit. It's a good news story. But we all love these kind of like heroic stories of adventure, of hunting lost treasure.
Absolutely,
it's very Raiders of the Lost Ark in a way.
Yeah, it's very much that way. And this has everything. I mean, exotic sort of Spanish galleons sinking and $3 billion, you know, for an economy like Colombia, short of cash, this will go down very well indeed. Thank you. I was touched to see there was a brief debate on whether they should return the galleon to Spain. I think it lasted several nanoseconds.
I was going to say, that was a very, very brief debate, I'm sure.
But also, I mean, these stories come with such fabulous pictures. I mean, you see those absolutely beautiful galleons sort of across the water, and you can't but think, you know, they don't make ships like that anymore.
No, that's right. It reminds me of a past era of maritime grace and swashbuckling derring do. All good stuff. And the president himself, of course, tweeting, and it's gone right at the top of the Colombian government. Huge excitement. Quite right.
And they've released a few pictures which show, I think they show through pots, actually, but they say that there could be up to 1,000 galleons who are kind of there on the coral reefs of Colombia. So this could be a kind of a good way of funding your government. Maybe that's what Mr. Maduro should have been doing. He should have been going off the coast looking for these galleons. That would have kind of saved his government.
Yes, who knows? A few things here. Of course, they found the San Jose where nobody had thought it would be. Some clever person worked out they'd all been looking in the wrong place. And they reckoned of those 1,000 galleons, there's another 4 or 5 that carried treasure, not quite as much as the San Jose, but really enough to go fishing for. So yes, there's a lot more where that came from.
They were also using some fantastic high-tech method to try and track where they would have been, using sort of wind speeds and currents and goodness knows what from way back.
We're going to have to leave it there. We started as a good political show. We ended up a bit like Treasure Hunt, but there you go. That was Mary Jadevsky and John Everard joining us here on Maduri House. And as I said, that's all we have time for today. The show was produced by Ben Ryland, and it was researched by Fernando Agustin Pacheco and Ilana Hanukov. And for me, Andrew Tuck, thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.